Going through, Brother Billy Hillier and I have been going through some examples of face-to-face meetings with Jesus. And have you ever been frustrated with an interruption? It's a rhetorical question, right? It's a constant battle. In my line of work, it's one of those things that it seems like a constant irritation, constant frustration. If not constant, at least a daily frustration. But I ask a silly question. My dad, when I was little, used to say, if you ask silly questions, you get silly answers. And whether or not, and he was not one of those that, you know, I've heard say many times since I grew up that there's no such thing as stupid questions. Nah, he didn't think that way. So whether or not my question is just rhetorical or just plain dumb, we look at this question to introduce the lesson. Interruptions. Sometimes you just want and maybe really need to stay on task. Not right now. Stop. Don't interrupt. Interruptions don't take into consideration how valuable time is or how urgent a task is. And then again, imagine walking around in Jesus' shoes while he was on earth. Surely being the Son of God, walking around in the flesh, came with 3 to 4 years of relentless interruptions. We think of our life as rough as we hear the phrases, excuse me, or I have a question for you, and We have to remember, imagine the interruptions that Jesus received. A great illustration of this, in my mind, is the movie where Jim Carrey was portraying God for a time. And how does God handle all of those prayer requests? You think about it from the human perspective. And Jim Carrey's character had prayer requests in email form. Treating the prayers of every living person in email form by answering yes to all was a bad plan. Everybody who asked won the lottery, but there wasn't enough money for everybody to win the lottery. See, so I thought it was interesting that those frustrations are something that we really get a grasp on. Frustration becomes or because of interruptions, is a part of life in every civilization, as far as I can imagine. And Jesus even showed his frustration, either because he truly was frustrated, or because of making a teaching moment. Case in point, Luke chapter 9. We'll be looking at verses 38 to 43. Behold, a man from the multitude shouted out, saying, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only boy." And behold, a spirit seizes him, and he suddenly screams, and it throws him into a convulsion with foaming at the mouth. And as it mauls him, it scarcely leaves him. And I begged your disciples to cast it out, and they could not. And listen to his reaction. O unbelieving and perverted generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? New American Standard Version. King James Version may even make it more impactful to me. How long shall I suffer you? Bring your son here. In verse 42, and while he was still approaching, the demon dashed him to the ground, threw him into a convulsion. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the boy and gave him back to his father. Now, I bring all of this up and to your attention to set the tone for an interruption that Jesus got. We'll be looking at the previous chapter, Luke chapter 8. An interruption that Jesus got on the way to someone's house. Verses 41 to 42. And behold, there came a man named Jairus. Now, that's the southern pronunciation, so it must be right. And he was an official of the synagogue. And he fell at Jesus' feet and began to entreat him and to come to his house, for he had an only daughter about 12 years old, and she was dying. Okay, so that sets the tone, doesn't it? But as he went, The multitudes were pressing against him. Side question, are any of you claustrophobic? I can imagine. This would be one of those stressors for you if you're claustrophobic. The King James adds a different twist to this in its translation. Verse 42, but as he went, the people thronged him. Now, what does that mean? So the Greek word is literally choked him. It comes from derivative words that mean drowning or strangle completely to crowd. I think that's significant to give us a picture, a mental image of just how pressed people were. And I wonder how many of those people in the crowd were able to reach him and grab his garments. More about that later. Hold that thought. This description that Luke brings us likely paints a picture much like Dallas Jenkins, I think, accurately depicts the scene in The Chosen. In The Chosen, the disciples seem to always be trying to protect their master from the crowds, like his security detail, much like, which has been in the news a lot lately, the Secret Service for the president. Maybe that was needed in actuality, but I keep hearing Jesus, I guess, correct them and using the scenarios for teaching moments. We'll be looking at Matthew 19 and 14 in just a moment. You may recall how people were bringing their children to Jesus and the disciples were playing security officers again. But Jesus said, suffer little children. King James likes that word, so used it there. Suffer little children and forbid them not to come to me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven. Use that as an example of what I'm talking about. They're trying to be a secret service and he's saying maybe not needed. The next part of our scene in Luke chapter 8 is really significant in my opinion and the reason for my introduction about interruptions. Remember, Jesus is pressing his way to the house of the Jewish synagogue official named Jairus, the Deep South theological pronunciation, so just hold on to that. I tried to go by the real pronunciation and it was worthless. His daughter, Jairus' daughter, is near death. It might be considered by most a matter of high importance to not pick up any hitchhikers on this road. In other words, the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. Urgency, urgency. She is dying. What can he do to get there and to prevent that? So we'll look at Luke chapter 8, verses 43 to 46. Here is the New American Standard Translation. We'll compare notes in a second. And a woman who had a hemorrhage for 12 years and could not be healed by anyone came up behind him and touched the fringe of his cloak. And immediately her hemorrhage stopped. And Jesus said, "Who is the one who touched me?" And while they were all denying it, that's interesting, Peter said, "Master, the multitudes are crowding and pressing upon you." Remember the word choking. But Jesus said, "Someone did touch me, for I was aware that power had gone out of me." And so the King James calls this malady here an issue of blood for 12 years, which had spent, speaking of her, had spent all of her living upon physicians, neither could be healed of any. Who touched me? So every square inch of Jesus' body was undoubtedly encompassed about by his disciples and the crowd. Here's a question nobody can answer, but I have a strong opinion about it. Did God in the flesh limit himself to not know the answer to his question, much like we would ask it? And I've got another question for you. And if you know the answer, say it out loud. What is often said, like a trivia question, so what is often said that mamas have in the back of their heads? Eyes. And that's a metaphor to say that mamas always seem to know when their kids are up to no good. And I don't believe that Jesus limited his ability to know who touched me. Not for a minute. And just as Brother Billy alluded to last week, this is proof of my opinion. Jesus twice told Nathanael at his first meeting some miraculous information that only he would know. Interesting. So who touched me? Well, you see, if Jesus wanted to, he could have put a force field around himself in Star Trek style glory and kind of made a bubble of sorts around him. He didn't have to allow that pressing to be upon him. He could have just kept the crowd away if he wanted to. Security detail, not really needed in my humble opinion. But somebody touched me. And that phrase, that statement, was a purposeful opportunity to bring to light a miracle that this woman received. And hear me out. If not, she could have and likely would have gone away quietly, knowing in her heart, without anyone else getting to share in this experience. And I'll tell you why in a moment, why I think that is. At the same time, Jesus used this situation to give her a chance to express her faith to a multitude of people. Remember, the crowd was all around. Think about the others that were pressing up against him, who didn't receive a miracle. At least we don't know of any. Why were they thronging him? What did they hope to gain? How many of those were close enough to touch him? If there were several, were they not healed or made better in some way? This woman's story sounds so sad and quite exhausting. But it helps when we know things. Life and Bible knowledge is much more rewarding when we know things. The Bible teaches us that in the Old Testament law, life is in the blood. That didn't change. Life is in the blood. Blood atones for sins. Blood mishandled is sinful and unclean. That was the Old Testament law. Prophet Isaiah equates his sinful condition to that of filthy rags. And I encourage you, and we will, look deeper into the meaning of that word filthy. Isaiah 64 and 6, but we are all as an unclean thing, and all our righteousnesses are as filthy rags, and we all do fade as a leaf, and our iniquities like the wind have taken us away. What of this word? Strong's Concordance indicates this word filthy just by itself, just the definition, is related to a woman's cycle of menstruation. It's believed by Knave and his concordance that this is what the lady's hemorrhage was related to. Now, we don't know. It doesn't say. The Bible's not spelling that out. Jesus really spends very little time here. But it just seems probable to me. How long has she dealt with this? 12 years. Let's clarify what that means. If her malady is related to what we're thinking, it's not just once a month for 12 months, but for every day for 144 months. Along this line of thinking, Isaiah wrote this in Isaiah 30 and 22, "Ye shall defy also the covering of thy graven images of silver, and the ornament of thy molten images of gold. Thou shalt cast them away as a menstruous cloth. Thou shalt say unto it, get thee hence." How abhorrent were false gods and the idols of that represented their blasphemous worship? According to this passage, they were to be considered disgusting. They were to be considered something not to be touched or possessed or handled or entertained in any way. And he illustrated it the way he did. And then again, why is it important? I just wonder, why is it important for Jesus to expose this lady to this scrutiny? She could have gone away silently. I think it's safe to say Jesus was to blame, not that there's a fault here, but he was to blame for shining a light on her. And some are thinking, why would I dare bring this up as a probable explanation, easy for me to say, of what she had been dealing with for over a decade? Why not just leave it alone? Hemorrhage says enough. Well, first, the Bible never claimed to sugarcoat any of its stories. You know, it's not like an autobiography I might write about myself. I'm going to leave the really rough stuff out, right? The Bible's very clear about some things, and sometimes they're not pleasant to hear. Sometimes the situations of the Bible describes in detail, they're vulgar. They're disgusting. Even taboo in certain circles. Remember what folks bought and ate during famines. Folks, that's nasty. But if I can relate to the people of the Bible more clearly, even with something in the Bible that shocks me, I'm more likely to learn how to be closer to God who healed them. Let's be honest. How many times, speaking of this lady's story in Luke chapter 8, how many times have you glossed over this poor woman's story, this hitchhiker on the road to Jairus' house? Just glossed over it. Well, that sounds tough. 12 years of hemorrhaging. How many times have you thought that 12 years is a long time, but you really just glossed over her ailment? Many, many times. What was she literally dealing with? Do you think she was bleeding from just a sore on her arm? You know, her blood coagulation had flawed in some way? That might be. Well, what about the law on this? So the unclean aspect under the Old Testament law can help us understand what this poor woman had been dealing with. How did society treat the woman with an issue of blood for any allowed time but for 12 years? How much compassion do you think she was awarded? Was this malady she dealt with public in nature? Not on her part. You would think she's trying to avoid that. How did her father treat her? How or was she and her family living under the Mosaic law? One would assume so. Could have been. And the law had something to say, Leviticus 15 and 19. When a woman has a discharge, if her discharge is in her body is blood, she shall continue in her menstrual impurity for 7 days. And whoever touches her shall be unclean until evening. For 144 months, if you want to use the numbers. So 7 days times 12 is 84 days throughout the year. Gentlemen, that's the normal time frame in rough numbers that our poor ladies go through this part of life. And this woman's 84 days for just that 1 year, which would have been over 1,000 days of impurity for 12 years, actually, her math turned into 4,380 days for those 12 years. I don't know about y'all, but that makes my eyes open a little bit bigger to why Jesus shone a light on her. What is her family supposed to do with her in this condition? Sadly, it's portrayed in The Chosen that she was an outcast by her family, her hometown, her friends. Did she have a husband? We don't know. Just interesting. What happened? She found it necessary to travel in the scene, travel to a town where no one knew her. You can imagine how truthful that would be. Imagine how urgent then this hitchhiker on Jesus' road to Jairus' house became to him that day. Who touched me? When we know things, when we know details, we can come to a better grasp of what Jesus wanted us to know and to get from her story. Well, how much money did she have? Mark gives us this description in Mark 5 and 26. She had endured much at the hands of many physicians and spent all that she had and was not helped at all, but rather had grown worse. It might interest you. I found this in Adam Clark's commentary, and it was an illustration from Rabbi Jochanan. Easy for me to say. And you just follow with me to listen to the physician's remedies. Take of gum Alexandria, of alum, and of crocus hortensis, the weight of a zuzi. We need somebody to tell us what a zuzi is. Let them be bruised together and given in wine to the woman that hath an issue of blood. But if this fails, take of Persian onions, 9 logs, boil them in wine, and give it to her to drink, and say, arise from thy flux. But should this fail, set her in a place where 2 ways meet, and let her hold a cup of wine in her hand, and let somebody come behind and affright her, like she had hiccups, and say, arise from thy flux. But should this do no good, take a handful of cumin, and a handful of crocus, and a handful of fenugreek. Let these be boiled and given her to drink, and say, arise from thy flux. But should this also fail, dig 7 trenches. You're going to love this. Dig 7 trenches and burn in them some cuttings of vines, not yet circumcised, meaning vines not 4 years old. And let her take in her hand a cup of wine, and let her be led from this trench and set down over that. And let her be removed from that and set down over another. And in each removal, say to her, arise from thy flux. I hate to be the one to state the obvious, but it sounds like not much has changed in the medical field as far as trial and error. What a crazy thing. And so this may not have been the kind of treatments the physicians used on the woman in our story, but it sounds plausible because of her state of just poor desperation and the fact that her condition just got worse. How utterly desperate she had become. Remember, Jesus had felt his power flow out of him because someone touched him. Luke 8:47-48. And when the woman saw that she had not escaped notice, she came trembling and fell down before him and declared in the presence of the people the reason why she had touched him. Do not miss this obvious thing, at least to me. While she was talking and describing her issue of blood with stained clothes and all, would not the people in the crowd have shuddered hearing of her issue of blood, sidestepping to distance themselves from her? But wait for the rest of her words. And how she had been immediately healed, he said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. Now Mark's account in Mark 5:25-34, I think it's worth reading the whole thing. For she thought, if I just touch his garments, I shall get well. And immediately the flow of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her affliction. And immediately Jesus perceived in himself that the power proceeding from him had gone forth, turned around in the crowd, who touched my garments. And his disciples said to him, you see the multitude pressing in on you, and you say, who touched me? And he looked around to see the woman who had done this, but the woman, fearing and trembling, aware of what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction. So Mark indicates that she told him and apparently everybody else in this multitude of a crowd the whole truth. No doubt this poor woman was miserable. I don't think I'm guessing to say she had done her level best to keep this condition as secret as possible. How would you like for something to be wrong with you, and you're just trying to go about your business, and just some stranger sees you and says, unclean, unclean, and you're just trying to survive? And now she's telling the whole truth with many witnesses. Of no fault of her own, she has had an unclean condition four times more than a woman's normal cycle. For a little background, I've had two grown daughters. I have two grown daughters who went through the rough teenage years. And if you don't know, the women in the women living in the same house will get on the same schedule each month. So you just haven't lived until you've had three cranky ladies who tend to set aside your feelings and parts of their Christian walk once or sometimes twice a month. You got an amen there? I see an elbow though. Maybe this helps though understand the magnitude of this poor woman's illness. Multiply the misery of our ladies times four with no hope of things getting better. All your life savings gone. And now, her hopefully private illness has been exposed for all the crowd in a spectacular face-to-face with the only physician who could heal her. After all the miserable times she dealt with this, what was her scale? Just a pondering question. What was her scale of embarrassment now that she's healed? Does she still feel ashamed? Does she feel outed in front of the crowd? When she leaves this place and goes to tell her story, will she tell her story or will she keep this face-to-face with Jesus quiet? What do you do there? I may have spent too much time on the nameless, this nameless woman who Jesus only has a few recorded words with her, but I believe Jesus gave her more time than what we read about, and for good reason. And like we noticed at the outset, Jesus was interrupted with this situation. And he was on the way to an important official's daughter who is dying. If Jesus had been concerned about networking, this would be a good contact. Jairus, we want to make sure we don't want to miss this appointment. Do I have to reiterate how truly great this was of a need? Look at Luke 8:49. Case in point. Remember, Jairus came humbly and begging Jesus to heal his 12-year-old daughter. 12 years old, 12-year affliction. That's an interesting thing. I don't know what you make of that. And his daughter was dying. Make no mistake about it. While the crowd is still scratching their heads over the healing of the woman. Verse 49, while he was still speaking, someone came from the house of the synagogue official and saying, "Your daughter has died. Do not trouble the teacher anymore." You have to wonder what was the mindset behind the person speaking to Jairus. Don't bother the teacher anymore. Being closely associated with Jairus, you got to wonder if he's questioning why Jairus ever went to Jesus in the first place. Remember, Jesus wasn't on great terms with the Jewish leadership. So let's look at verse 50 and following. But when Jesus heard this, he answered him, "Do not be afraid any longer. Only believe, and she shall be made well." And when he had come to the house, he did not allow anyone to enter with him except Peter and John and James and the girl's father and mother. Now they were all weeping and lamenting for her, but he said, "Stop weeping, for she has not died, but is asleep." And they began laughing at him, knowing that she had died. He, however, took her by the hand and called, saying, "Child, arise," and her spirit returned, and she rose immediately. And it occurs to me, Luke gives us a view into how this thing works. Life and death. Body and spirit. Her spirit returned. Is that a description said concerning any or all of the other examples of resurrections from the dead? I mean, somebody has to ask dumb questions, and that's me. A less than exhaustive search performed found Luke's account here saying these words together, referring to a spirit returning. And I don't find this language around raising of Lazarus, for instance. But there was this in 1 Kings 17 and 21 concerning the widow of Zarephath. And he stretched himself upon the child three times and cried unto Jehovah and said, O Jehovah, my God, I pray thee, let this child's soul come into him again. Interesting. Well, maybe a deeper study will show an obvious theme that gives us a clear glimpse of this departure of the spirit from the human body. But the verse that we're studying continues. And he gave orders for something to be given her to eat, and her parents were amazed. But he instructed them to tell no one what had happened. Now, I have to ask, have you considered that the laughter, which sometimes laughter is good and sometimes it's really bad. Have you considered that the laughter of the mourners who scorned Jesus was a good and a bad thing? Imagine knowing what we know now about Christ, who Jesus is, what he was willing to do in service for us. He is the one that Isaiah 59 was talking about, that God's hand is not so short that it cannot save. He's the one who pulled us out of the deep when we were drowning, because his hand is that long and that big and that strong. Imagine knowing what we know now, and we happen to be in the house mourning the 12-year-old daughter of the family. Imagine, with our knowledge of Jesus' power and deity, would we ever laugh at him? Would we laugh him to scorn? The word scorn defined is ridicule, disparage, disrespect. That's how it's bad. It's disrespectful at times. And that was the best or the bad side, of course, but you knew that already. So how could laughter be a good thing in this situation? Those who would be so bold as to laugh at Jesus are helping confirm this miracle really took place, because they knew she had died. Have you considered that this healing mission, this road trip to Jairus' house, and the interruption by the woman with the issue of blood, Dr. Luke penned both spectacular events in 16 verses. Why not a whole book? Right? That's the way we would look at it, maybe. We have a hemorrhaging woman for 12 years and a full-fledged resurrection, and there's very little mentioned about them. Does that seem odd to you? The why questions for Jesus, they are bound, don't they? Though very little was said, and comparing Matthew's and Mark's accounts shed only a glimmer of extra light, these were pivotal events in the ministry of Jesus. With all the opposition Jesus was receiving from the Jewish leadership, to get a toehold in the door of one of their synagogue officials, that was significant. That seems like that would be really a great thing. But don't go and tell anybody what just happened here today. Was Jairus' status in leadership important for Jesus' politics? Well, I believe his statements to the Jewish leadership prove politics was the least of his concerns. And isn't it interesting that it took a dying daughter, very possibly, to touch this Jewish leader's heart to develop his strong faith in the power of a teacher from where? Nazareth. Is it interesting to only me that our illness, is definitely of our own making? Jesus is the only one who can produce the power from himself to stop our bleeding. In one sense, we are sheltered from public scrutiny, much like the lady wanted to be in most of those 12 years, no doubt. But in a greater context, our illness is exposed to the public like our unclean condition was. With our mouths, we are demanded to confess not our sins individually, so every person knows that we've done on our walk to the foot of the cross. Our condition is exposed. We are to confess that we are powerless, and Jesus is the powerful. Make no mistake, though, in sin, man is bleeding himself dry. That makes it pretty important, doesn't it? It's a life or death situation. A blood transfusion is in high demand. A resurrection is absolutely necessary if we hope for eternal life. We are hopeless without it. We are hopeless without Him. I can't imagine what it's going to really be like to be face to face with Jesus. Can you imagine the day when we get to see Him as He is? Hope that helps. Lesson is yours. Thank you for your attention. The party may begin.